Blog Talk Radio.
Sonic Effects. Been a busy week, hasn't it? You notice your own life, not mine. Things are happening all over the place, and we're left with, oh my goodness, you know, this fussy jazz hands. There's too much. It's on overload. It's on overload. from 100 years ago, it was overload. It's too much. And, like, when I was away, we'd walk out to the end of the lane to the mailbox, and that was something a grandchild was carrying, and you would pick up the weekly newspaper. In where I was, Prince Edward Island, it was the Winnipeg Press, and maybe that's why I never thought of it. Maybe that's why I have been subscribing to Manchester Guardian since I discovered it in my university days. A weekly, you know, the daily. If I lived in London, perhaps, but I don't. I'm here in the colonies. The overload. How much information was needed? Well, once in a while, it was okay when news came with a traveler. That wasn't so very long ago. Now it's like there's so much that it almost seems cluttered. And yet in all of that, it hasn't changed. We have a lot of things that don't have much value, disposable ideas, disposable. Now we're becoming aware of disposable clothes and the impact on the environment. The timelines between event and impact, consequences intended and otherwise, are shortening in a way. But how to communicate that? Once upon a time, well, most of my, certainly the adult life since World War I particularly, has been filtered, heavily, heavily filtered. And before that, it was controlled. You know, when we were thinking about Renaissance, we're bringing back ideas and renewing and refreshing our sense of Rome and Greece. And then we think, well, what was going on? Something in the Gestalt was feeding on this need, bringing this information forward to re-explore, and something was lost in the past. And then we're rolling up our sleeves and dealing with the impact of the Age of Enlightenment, particularly or fondly, because we were built on that. We were built on the writings and the thinking and the events and the impact, certainly, our values out of such an oddity, like the City of London, you know, and the people that were influential. That was completely elitist, and there's no doubt about it. But we pull our togas tightly around us and give a thumbs down to it. Let's not be quite so smug. Was there nothing of value? Well, far from it. There was a great deal. And now the likes of the meagerness of me can plunder the history and find the brilliance. There were some brilliant things. There's jingoism and things that are enormously unpleasant. And so that is too what it is. But that's not the point of this program. There's enough emphasis on that, and that's salacious. Their media, the media feeds on it, doesn't it? Not that they would turn the cameras on themselves and all the time, or have somebody hiding in the bushes wanting with a long lens and their own lives, because very few of us could really stand up to that level of scrutiny. My goodness. Even the Puritans are being revisited. And this notion of the freedom fighters, far from it, and released from tyranny. They were kicked out because they were doing some really silly things, you know, odd things. Aggression, always aggression, da-da-da-da-da. So the things that grab our collective attention seem to be for shock value. It's always been, well, it's been for a long time. A little flesh will turn heads. It's like the meerkats in a classroom, or you're sitting there listening intently to a lecture, somebody that's really putting it together, worked very hard on to develop the material, and he's an orator. And a little squeak of the door in the back, and you see all the meerkats' heads pop up, and immediately they're distracted. They have such a lack of focus. Yeah, you notice it. And certainly the speaker notices, and not a comment. It's so awkward, one of those awkward little truths that whatever's being said, however important, how much praise we might be lauding on the speaker and the topic, a little squeak, the click of a door, and the heads pop up and turn to see who it is. Well, we know it's because it's a phalanx of warriors that are coming in to attack us from the rear. Well, of course, it's obvious that we need to be alert like that. It's also a comment about our presence of mind and focus. There's other times when we are collected in our own minds and it doesn't matter what's happening. You push it away. The focus is on that one experience, that one event, that one thought. You see it in campuses all the time, that this geeky looking woman or man walking across, and they're chattering to themselves. They've got the argument going in their own mind, completely unconscious of the observation. Nobody's laughing at them because everybody's doing it. You have that narrative happening in your own head. And they're working through ideas, and it's bloody brilliant. We apply those types of filters now to be tested and put it to the test. It's not what an editor is telling me or selecting. It's not curated news. How many curators do I have? Well, curators have their own slant, don't they? Their own spin on events. So is it a political spin, a theological spin, an economic spin, a conspiracy of sorts? My goodness. Woe is me, I have to make a decision about me and what's important to me and expose my own thinking to myself and the world around. Is this what I'm really like? Is this what my taste is? How do I value my private? Do I have a sense of character? Well, these are very penetrating questions. not exactly for faint of heart, but today we're going to dip into this a little bit. Just to, don't want to frighten people away too much. Well, maybe we do. To have that awareness that what we're doing collectively is accepting a challenge. You're, even to be aware that you're doing it tells you and the rest of us that this isn't mediocrity. No, you can be angry and say, what I'm finding has to fit with my mindset. Well, we know that. Good luck with that. Good luck with that. But that kind of mindset doesn't really do well and doesn't thrive. It's not nurtured in an atmosphere of exploration. Because these are folks that are coming with an orthodoxy, with a doctrinaire approach to the world. This is authoritarianism raw and dripping with whatever viscera they've caused on the face of the world. It gets around to, in some measure here, it gets around to the likes of me talking to you about some assumptions that the world is not as messed up as some would say. Just because somebody says something. I was listening to a person the other day who was getting some testing while in hospital, and they picked up a minor bubble, you know, a little heart murmur here and there. And his wording, his thinking, you know, neurolinguistics does have a bearing on us. His thinking was, this is complete, you know, everything he was getting ready for discharge. This is it was a bit of a surprise. So control, the world is just, everything's just, you know, he was panicking. Well, my goodness, you've got this equipment. You want the analysis because it tells your doctors and you some vital pieces of information. What's out of control about that? What's out of control about that? It's like when mathematics brings up something that we don't want to know. Well, I've decided that the wingspan should be like this. Well, is it? Or the plans B-56? Is that the planes that the wings were too short? You know, one a day would be destroyed in Tampa where they were training pilots. The training, they lock a plane a day. Well, you know, you can't have that. The engineers are doing their job. Everybody's doing their job. And this is in production, except it didn't work. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Didn't work. Hard to take off, hard to land. No flexibility at all. And then what do we do? Do we pout and say, well, let's just ignore it. You know, it's pilot error. It's human error. Let's reexamine the math. It's the stuff that we rely on when we get into a jam. How do we use that, though? That's what we're going to look at today. How do we use it? Nobody, you know, when we look at our personal life, is there to tap us on the shoulder and say, unless you're confident and you have that conversation with yourself in your head where your common sense and your conscience have reached a level of an awareness that it's like a conversation in your mind where you can say, this is what I need to do. This is the filter that I need. I need to have that sense of responsibility. I need to, at the end of the day, do things, re-examine them, and then decide whether I am as responsible as I feel I need. I think I am. Am I as observant? It was very hard for me and I think it is for a lot of people, when you make observations, then you have that so what moment. So what, I make this observation. Let's say the observation is the world is unpredictable. There's probability that just rains. May not be in the emperor's seat, but it might be close by. And I've heard people say, well, nothing is predictable. You stats, you can manipulate it. Yeah. if you're a bit foolish, you can. If that's what you think, well, it's the truth. You have to be accurate. There's a responsibility that goes with it. Yeah. And if what they do when they say that type of thing is reveal so much about their own character. You know, I can't be trusted with stats because they'll manipulate you. But instead, they talk about the worthlessness of the tools that they've never applied. Never applied, but opinion, you know. Teenage mentality, you don't need a lot of fact when you're driven by so much accuracy of opinion. What's it say about you? Well, that's what time gives you. It allows you to do. And if you're if you're fortunate and you're observant and you have some guidance at an earlier age, you can go through life. And I see a lot of young people that do are aware at a very, very early age. They have a gift, I would say. And is it all, when you're aware like that, the world doesn't slip a pair of rose-colored glasses on you. We begin to see what is there, the world as it is, and us as we are. And then hopefully you've arrived at high hope in my heart, that you arrive at some philosophical turning point and begin to realize it's okay. It does. These are things that tell you about yourself, your awareness of your behavior, your sense of identification that comes from the looking at the people that you associate with. It's wonderful. The people, you know, you're known by your company in a way, yeah. But look at them. Are they people that are beautiful and respectful and challenging and are striving to achieve? Do they have purpose? Do they have aim? That tells you, reluctantly or not, about yourself. That the sensitivity about, you know, always running yourself down, questions have been addressed beautifully by psychology for a long time. Given an opportunity to criticize somebody, ask the person to level their criticisms of their work first. And for the most part, unless somebody's playing games and being a bit cunning, for the most part, people's criticism of themselves is far harsher than the observer. It's an old ploy of human resources, you know, those wizards and masters of self controlling the masses to get a result. Never quite works, but these are just simple examples of what happens when you hone your skill. You can recall, if you're anything like me, thinking, my goodness, I'm thick as a brick. I'm not a very observant person. And then took a certain age where you realize, and just being able to understand that requires some degree of observation. Here, let's get right down to it. Roll up the sleeves. What I'm talking about here is us as Freemasons today in 21st century. And the law, ti-da, the laissez-faire attitude about members and membership. I like that it's opportunity. Not everybody, you know, I believe that. I think it's a limited opportunity. I don't think we have vast resources where we can just say, well, you know, if you have maleness about you these days, I'm trying to be contemporary here, boys. If you have maleness about you, that you have met the test and will apply the learnings, and then we hopefully we'll cross our fingers and see what the results are. Has our trust been misplaced or not? Is it been valued? I'm not so sure anymore that I agree that we have that kind of resource. Maybe once upon a time, we could just pop up oil fields wherever we needed them. But today there's consequences for doing that, just like there is for, you know, putting up a roadside stand and say, here, We're going to have those great big field days, and we're going to initiate hundreds of you to sign up, and we'll do it all one day. Anything to make it a drive-through experience for you. I'm not one of those. And in fact, I would probably be talking, to come full circle with this, talking to the person and with an eye for observation, my observation of him. And I want to know more about his own awareness of observation. Is he an observant man? An arrogant son of a gun might say, yeah, of course I am. And they go on to explain it, because after you put your foot in your mouth, if you have a shred of intelligence, it's not hard to put together an argument. It's like people that have a conclusion and then want to create the science that leads to the conclusion. We've seen that released at different times. You watch the scientific journals, you see that. Not the good ones, no. Even they can be fooled occasionally, but very rarely. And the consequence is not something you want to go through. Believe me, it's you just, why do that? The trickster, right? Not science. You have findings and then you apply them. And masonry oozes with that kind of metaphor, analogy, the symbolism. Even starts to open the mind. And once that happens, oh my goodness, that's perilous, isn't it? Because it's all going to rush us to the event horizon. We're looking down into the abyss. So, damn that Eve eating the apple of reason. It was so much easier when we never had reason. We just could. Here's the canons. Follow them, you'll live a good life. No questions asked. Except, we have reason, we have agency, and nobody is about to tell you don't. They can try. Yeah. Like the little aberrations that build themselves up with this really pathological notion that fear is respect. Yeah, they don't do well. They don't do well. We're supported these days by this surge of science. It's giving us a stronger sense of division, and we're concerned about that division. There are people who are don't have access to the privilege. And we can describe that in so many ways. I won't even get into it right now. To live, with some sense of respect and rights and protections. The whole world doesn't have that. But then when we look around the globe at this global community, we're cruising into 8 billion of us. The larger questions are coming about this community. What can be done about poverty and suffering and responsibility? Well, it's my country and you don't have a bearing on that. Go away. Well, we become mutually accountable. We're sending barbs and missives at each other. You're not very polite. And look what you've done. Well, don't tell me what I've done. Look in your own neighborhood there, pal. Well, mutual accountability. The rise in the source of authority is for a conspiracy theorist. Let's have it. You think there's somebody is pulling the levers that maintains their control? Yeah, I think that there are. If you've gained control in the far and distant, you're not likely to give it up because it's too much power. No. Now the source of that power has shifted. You look at the needle, public accountability, public awareness, and it matters. So we're examining the wackiness, some of the weirdness that goes on. Like, how can people completely believe that? It just doesn't make any sense. Or they're saying things and making it up as they go along. Well, that's the question of credibility. And what price are we prepared to pay to have a credible source? Well, we haven't found that. You might have yours. I might have mine. But if you're thinking about 8 billion of us, how are we going to validate and legitimate the authority, not to rule and run our lives, but to authenticate the reliability of information? Well, right now, it's science. It's art. You want to know something penetrating about love. I'll give you, and why we clumsily seem to be complaining about falling over ourselves, that is the real power. It's like this. It's like that sensation that never quite goes away when you're sitting, you're quiet with an infant, and they're still, their eyes are still developing, and they don't have language, but you can have a conversation with them because they have an understanding before they have the language capability. It's like they can walk, but they don't have the neurological control of muscle. They're still developing for infants. Do you remember that feeling when those little tiny fingernails reach and grab your baby finger and just hold it? Do you remember that feeling unlike anything else? Yeah, you do. And if you haven't yet, it'll come. It's a wonderful sensation. Yeah, and I know there's pain in the world. But that kind of sensation, that's very, very powerful. Funny that masonry doesn't approach our thinking in terms of fear-based notions. It does it with this sense of wonder, with a sense of observation, this encouragement to love the experience, to be observant and to put things into context. It's just absolutely amazing and a pleasure. Can you imagine the pleasure of having the likes of you and me able to sit down together for short periods of time? Absolutely fantastic. I hope you enjoy the program today. A little bit of Alfred Tennyson going on here. And the music, poof, here. Check for yourself. This is pretty cool. Stefan Grappelli, you go to my head. Yeah. I know, an awkward kind of a segue for this. When we experience science and artistry, it is just for times like this that Freemasonry was developed. The lessons of turmoil are never far from awareness. When our worlds become unstable, everyone, not just the elite, suffer more. The aid, whether by food or intellectual resources, assistance to resolve frontier wars and the protections of societies, all come to an end. The world, in whatever way it is described, becomes keenly aware that conflict is overwhelmingly painful. See fear in the faces of everyone we meet is chilling. Finding courage and resolve is our only way to push back madness. From that cauldron, Freemasonry, with enough secrecy to ensure we are aware we are never alone in our thoughts. Don't condemn too quickly the brethren who felt the need to constantly remind you of what you already knew or know. They didn't and don't have your vision. The more history we absorb, the more attention we give to understanding the layered meaning of ritual, the more questions we have to direct our thinking. We are the labor organization for philosophy. We are the unregulated support of understanding. We are what truth to power produces. But in contradiction with subjugation, we do it out of curiosity. Let's mix these chemicals and see what happens. Apparently, looking for beauty enhances discovery of beauty. Apparently, we can direct dreams with satisfying results. Apparently, when people learn about virtues and consider arguments that establish the benefits of an ethical existence, not only is it influential, but transformative. To get there, a man comes to terms with ego, with rashness, with a desire to be popular, in exchange for respect. We begin with an experience that takes us to understanding. If you trust your capability, never give up. To find the tree that will shade you and your awareness, be comfortable being in the forest, knowing, but not really knowing.
Hey.
Have you ever been in a place where discovery and research is happening all around? Have you, can you imagine? I won't ask you to do that. Have you ever been in a place where there's creativity happening around you? If it's not part of your occupation or your life, you can find those opportunities. You search them out. And to participate, it's like being in a theater group. You develop an interest, you develop your own interest first, and then join up with this group of people, not to dominate it, but to participate, to find your talent, and to be part of something that's bigger than you. What if, for whatever reason, life circumstance, your connection there is, it changes and you have to move on. Do you think that the impressions that you gained in that atmosphere would be lost, would be erased from your memory or your experience? I only bring this up. I'm for one thing, no, you know, experience stays with you. What you take from it, whether you're an observer or whether you're a sponge you absorb or not, well, I don't know if people that are those little blocks of wood ever find their way into those environments. And if they do, I don't know if that's the qualifier for that epiphany, you know, where, oh my goodness, there's so much more. It's like the laborer who actually has the skills, the dexterity to be a surgeon, and just needs the science, and just needs the training, and just needs to be mentored, but goes through a whole life with a capacity for that, you know, that stillness that we need when we trust our loved ones in the hands of these surgeons. Whew. Well, it's like that. So does the laborer walk around thinking, oh, well, I could be a surgeon, you know? So it's not quite like that. I'm one of those folks that think, you know, potential doesn't mean anything unless you make it happen, unless you demonstrate it. I bring this up because of the poet that we're plunging into today, Alfred Lord Tennyson. And you can read about this guy. This is a fellow that whose work would be coming out. He was born in 1809, so you know our ritual would be gaining traction. Not the necessarily the uniformity. I even wonder what kind of thinking goes into that question of uniformity. Do you allow, you know, different nascent ritual to? It's not like anybody had to ask your permission; they just did it. And then to think, well, I'm going to impose uniformity on your traditions. Yeah, no. But after that. Well, that was the period he was born in 1809. So his work with coming out died in 18. When did he die? Oh, my goodness. I'll tell you. He died in 1892. He was an old dude, 83. And here, his occupation is given. Can you imagine? His occupation is given as poet laureate. How beautiful is that? The reason I bring up that question about the atmospheres and forgetting is that when he was a boy, he had the advantage of his access to Cambridge for his education. But before he could finish his degree, his dad died, and so he returned home, and he was, as they say, permitted to live for another 6 years and shared responsibility for his mom and the family. So he stayed with the family for a while. And then in 1833, 2 years later, after his dad died, he published his second book of poetry. And now he took on heavy criticism. So he was feeling discouraged, and he didn't publish again for 10 years. But he kept writing. He just didn't put it out there. How many people we shared on this program that have went through the same kind of thing, the concern about how the public is going to react and the concern about comment, gossip, you know, the critic. But it's fake. But thank goodness, this is, and he went on to be, as I said, his career was poet laureate. Do you think his work would have been lost? I tend not to think that. We're going to jump into a poem today called Tears, Idle Tears. This is from a portion of a larger work that he did, one of his more famous works in something called The Princess. And he writes here about it's called Tears, Idle Tears. And here the speaker sings of it's a song. And as I've been pointing out, that a lot of you are poets and followers of poetry, only you don't may not have just noticed that the poetry in the lyrics that you of the songs they're sent to you as songs. This one, the singer speaks of the baseless and inexplicable tears that rise in his heart and pour forth from his eyes when he looks out in the fields of autumn and thinks of the past. This is like nostalgia, isn't it? And if you've walked along the fields, when I close my eyes and think about this description, I'm thinking about a day early in the morning in the summer when the dew was heavy and having my little rubber boots and following as fast as my little legs could carry me behind the big strides of my grandfather. Going across the field, and he never minded me tagging along with him. I can't imagine, you know, this is getting up before the house at 5 o'clock. And I knew he got up and we'd head out before breakfast. And he was going out to check on the woodlot and see with trees to cut and split. And we'd go out for the walk together, and he would talk to me. The old mason would be talking to this little boy. Little did I know at the time what he was telling me. But you can sense the tears when I think about it. It's a beautiful memory. And this past, the days that are no more in the song, it's described as fresh and strange. It's this fresh as the first beam of sunlight that sparkles on the sail of a boat. I don't walk around thinking like that, but when somebody says that, is that freshness? Mm-hmm. Yeah. If you've ever been out sailing, yeah. and bringing the dead back from the underworld. You can allow yourself to remember the first time you met, the corny sense of humor, and it's sad, like the red beam of sunlight that shines on a boat and carries the dead down to the underworld. You know that myth. And do you have a coin for the ferryman? So you're allowed to pass. And here the speaker refers to the past not as fresh, but sad and strange. Sort of in a melancholy frame of mind. That's okay. But as such, it resembles the song of the birds in early summer mornings. And it's calling out, you know, trying to get some friends. And it sounds to a dead person who lies watching the glimmering square of sunlight as it appears through a square window. And in the last stanza, the speaker declares the past to be very dear and sweet and deep and wild. It's as dear as the memory of the kisses of one who is now dead. And it is sweet as those kisses that we imagine ourselves bestowing on lovers who actually have loyalties to others, secrets. So too is the past, as deep as first love, as wild as the regret that usually follows this experience. The speaker concludes that the past is a death in life. Oh, man. This is open verse, so it doesn't have a rhyme to it. Idle, idle tears. I know not what they mean. Tears from the depth of some divine despair rise in the heart and gather in the eyes. I must have allergies. And looking at the happy autumn fields and thinking of the days that are no more. Fresh as the first beam glittering on a sail that brings our friends up from the underworld. Sad as the last which reddens over one that sinks with all we love below the verge. So sad, so fresh, the days that are no more. Ah, sad and strange as in dark summer dawns, the earliest pipe of half-awakened birds, dying airs when unto dying eyes the casement slowly grows a glimmering square. So sad, so strange, the days that are no more. Dear, as remembered kisses after death, and sweet as those but hopeless fancy feigned on lips that are for others, deep as love, deep as first love, and wild with all regret and, oh, death in life, the days that are no more. So come over. We'll listen to Bill together. We'll sip a little whiskey later. Yeah. It'll be fun. Do you really buy this line that the history tells us about ourselves, helps us learn about ourselves? Wait, whose history? We all have our own. Is it the one that we identify with culturally, you know, tribally? Well, we've sorted out a little, I call it sorting out a little bit about the effect of the Enlightenment. I've been thinking about getting into the development of masonry in Russia. Russian history is a fascination. And I could do the same. Hopefully we'll have time and get into Italian Freemasonry. And maybe couldn't do that justice without brushing on the notions. Well, the Illuminati didn't start in Italy. Anyway, the development of masonry in Germany as well. So what's coming ahead? I would hope that, you know, it's, for me, it's like looking at, it's stylized. It's looking at different styles of thinking because of the emphasis that history places on certain events more than others. And it helps us to understand. Getting into Turkish history, trying to understand the Ottoman Empire. Who does these kind of things? Who does these kind of things? As we get more and more into the ideas, you know, uncovering ideas and sorting them out, you notice if you look around that the audience around us changes. It becomes smaller, doesn't it? Well, of course it does. It's like we've got we're sifting. We throw in a shovel full of gravel from the bottom of the stream, and we start shaking it. We vibrate it, and it's sifting out bigger particles, and the smaller screens pick up the smaller, depending on how many layers and the pickup differences in weight. So hopefully we find those nuggets at the bottom. But which size? We're looking for nuggets here. But it's in relation to your own thinking and your own growth and your own development, whether it matters. But the audience will be smaller because it becomes more esoteric and it requires more commitment. Yeah, I wouldn't expect you to sit through anthropology classes unless you're inclined, unless you're intelligent enough in the liberal arts to value this excursion into the more what we used to call the hardcore sciences. And some would barely be able to tolerate it. They would dumb it down, take what they consider to be the easiest. And how many of those easiest courses have clung to them? You know, if you're doing something in the maths and you're studying philosophy, well, you're going to find, whoops, it's not, the dividing line is almost non-existent. It's more about your indifference or your lack of information or understanding that creates this big barrier. If I say there's a barrier, there's a bloody barrier. Here we've been talking about barriers back in 18th century stuff. How much does this influence us today? Well, it influenced the world that we live in, major influences, the definitions of major powers is changing, as it always does. For historians and antiquarians, it's fascinating watching the decline and rise, and seeing how we're, you know, our little noses are out of joint all over the place. I think a joint correction, nose joint correction, is that should be a course in Freemasonry, to be able to notice everybody gets their nose out of joint during these periods, not just whoever is prepared and proclaiming. Here is a reminder that at every turn, the clerical and social institutions, this is the 1790s we're looking at, in the various ancient regimes, were frustrated by the almost harmless desire for social equality based upon merit or the institution of the religion of humanity. How dare they? This had already been sorted out. We had church and state, we had monarchs and divine rights of kings, and we chopped off Charles the First, you know. And not that his progeny was any less of a sense, he lived with any less of a sense of entitlement, the promiscuous little rascal. But here we have, you know, remnants, this affront, this group causing this affront. Here we are espousing equality, social equality and merit. What the hell kind of world are we living in? And yet the emphasis on education and personal virtue and decorum within the lodge must have given dedicated brothers a sense of their own worth and ability. Well, we can't have that. What happens to the bloodlines? What happens to Eton and Oxford? And, you know, we set up these institutes to teach leadership and government. We teach a sense further reinforced by the hierarchy based upon merit established amongst themselves. We cannot have that. They're basing a hierarchy on merit. And by the claim that Freemasons had a unique purchase on ancient wisdom. I like that reminder that whether we're with a crowd that is all populist, we, our values, our traditions are about a hierarchy based on merit. And we're layered according to merit, not the color of our skin or our accent or our history. And we're doing this ourselves. So if you, in your lodge, you establish that, it's a blessing. Given this opportunity, some men might indeed try to transform those private utopian impulses, however rhetorical and secretive their original expression may have been, into a concrete social reality. We just cannot have that. In the 1770s, and again in the 1790s, a few taverns associated with English lodges were used as places to discuss a Republican Congress for a new modeling of the Constitution, voting rights for women, the American Revolution, and then the French Revolution. Such extraordinary transformations would inevitably entail a massive reform and alteration of the old order, a break from the past so abrupt as to constitute a new and secular form of apocalyptic action. Just kept beyond belief here, gentlemen. Now to you, that's all I'm going to get into today. So to you, I say this, is history repeating itself? We still are struggling with questions about equality and merit, power, I guess, authenticity. It seems to me that we're repeating. And isn't it fascinating? Isn't it fascinating? Is awareness expanding? When I look at what's produced in television these days, I think, What if it was used to educate and illustrate and enlighten? And we would still have questions about who's doing the curating and who's pulling the levers and why. What's the motivation? So that we can trust the results. You're not going to put a spin on it that is going to subvert some of my life and my worth in order to serve your purpose. I want that clear. But it's trial and error. You try it, we catch you, we punish you, and then we move on. The punishment is you have no credibility. You become irrelevant. My gosh, my golly. Charlie Mingus, but it's time to go. Now, you're always welcome. I'd like to continue this on and get into some of these ideas more and more. I'll be talking about this changing audience, the changes that you notice going on around. But think of if you're seeing things, your group becoming smaller, think of it as that sieve. But there are people that aren't interested, not invested enough to do the work that is required to share that group. There's different strata, there's different cohorts, and you're part of a smaller cohort, and that is, I think, a credit to you. Don't be panicking and thinking, oh well, everybody should, everybody can. Well, truth is, no. There's lots of reasons people can't, and there's lots of reasons people don't. You know in your heart that what's going on and the effort that you make has little to do with elitism and everything to do with merit. So I applaud you for that. I sincerely applaud you. I enjoy being in your company because of the potential that I will learn things and that I trust. In those groups where things are taken seriously, I have a greater sense of trust. So I look forward to being with you again. And the next time I'm with you, I'm going to be, according to the calendar, I'm going to be a year older. So happy birthday to me. I'll wish you all well and hope that you will continue those random acts of Masonic kindness. Include yourself. My gosh, include yourself. Thank you.